I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
It was a good time. It was a really good time for New York. It was a great time for cooking, for students of cuisine, for the culinary arts. You know, there was an emergence of young American chefs who had done their time either in France or Italy or in the great kitchens of New York City who were finally coming into their own. And I like to describe it as the moment when we shifted from the type of cuisine being described by the country you were trying to emulate to the person you were. Mm. So like Italian and French food became Jean-Georges food and Tom Colicchio food and Alfred Portali food, and people understood what that meant.
That is chef, author, and healthy lifestyle crusader Rocco Dispirito on his early days as a chef in New York City.
Around 5 in the morning, my phone rings, and it's one of the residents here in the building. He just said, "Scott, there's a fire here." And I put on whatever clothes was closest to the bed, and I drove here as quick as I could, and I was the first person here. I tried to go in the back door, and I couldn't, because when I opened that back door, it created a vortex or a suction, and just hot embers came flying at me. And I went around to the front door, hoping it would be different, and it was. And so I was able to go into the kitchen. Basically, there was a waterfall inside of the restaurant because the water risers for the building had melted due to the heat. And it was just, as I showed you the video today, it was just a waterfall coming in from the ceiling.
And that is Chef Scott Verricchio of Vero Beach, Florida, who made the best of a terrible situation when his restaurant was hit by a fire 2 years ago. They are our guests today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. We have a double header episode for you today. First, part one of a very personal interview with Chef Rocco Dispirito. And that will be followed by a conversation with an old friend of mine, Chef Scott Verricchio, whose restaurant was destroyed by a fire 2 years ago, and who made use of the time while it was being rebuilt to stage in some of the best restaurants in the United States, and he did that at age 59. It's quite a story. First, if you'll indulge me for just 1 minute, we are in the midst of what we're calling an awareness drive here on Andrew Talks to Chefs. As mentioned a few times recently, we are unabashedly, unapologetically asking you to help us stand out in a never-ending flood of new podcasts that are crowding the virtual airwaves. Just as politicians are asking for your vote this season, we are asking you to help us sustain and grow the show by doing one or more of the following. This will just take a moment. You can rate and or review the show on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere. This takes about as long as it does to rate an Uber driver, so that's the easiest thing. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. It's free and will ensure that you receive new shows in your queue automatically each week. You can visit the AndrewTalksToChefs.com website. We are no longer affiliated with our former host network, and we're trying to nudge our own site to the top of search engine results when people go looking for the show. So even a one-time visit to the site will help us inch our way up the food chain on Google and other search engines. And most powerfully, perhaps, you could tell a friend about this show. This week, we're asking any of you cooks or chefs out there to tell fellow cooks or chefs, either with a mention on social media, with an individual or mass email or text, or just by, you know, mentioning it to a friend that you think might enjoy it. That would be very powerful, and we would appreciate it. Thank you for indulging me on this. I know it maybe seems like a lot to ask, but I'm telling you, it's a jungle out there. There's thousands of new podcasts every month, and we really do want to reach as many people as possible and help this show find the biggest audience it can. So thanks in advance for your support. Okay, moving on. I'm so excited about this. Our first guest today is Chef Rocco Dispirito. You might know him from Television, where he's hosted his own shows over the years and appeared on many other people's shows. You might know him from his books, which are focused increasingly on healthful lifestyle and eating. And you might know him as the chef who reemerged onto the New York dining scene last year. Unfortunately, it proved to be a short-lived return. I hope he'll give it another go, but I was thrilled to enjoy his food in a restaurant for the first time in forever. I made a point of doing that maybe four or five times over just a couple of months. Rocco is someone I think, if you know him in any of those contexts, I think today you're probably going to get to know, unless you were around the New York dining scene in the late 1990s, a different Rocco than you may be aware of. Back in 1998, Rocco Dispirito was the hottest chef in New York City. More importantly, he was one of the very best chefs cooking in New York City at that time. At Union Pacific Restaurant in the Flatiron District of Manhattan, Rocco took the training that he amassed in restaurants around the world and in New York and seized the attention of the industry with audacious, delicious, exciting food that inspired the likes of a young Paul Liebrandt and drove critics of the time like Ruth Reichel and Gail Green to rapturous praise in their reviews. Ruth actually went on to make Rocco the first chef ever to grace the cover of Gourmet magazine while she was the editor there. In time, Rocco stepped away, for the most part, from the restaurant stoves and started pursuing books and television and other things. And many of our younger listeners may not know any of what I just described at all, so I think it will be a revelation for you. I also think many people will be surprised to learn about the circumstances of his upbringing in a very tough neighborhood in Queens, New York, and also about how much education he's obtained. For someone who found the kitchen young, Rocco not only went to the Culinary Institute, but after spending time out in the world learning how to cook and honing those skills, he actually went to Boston University to get a business degree. That's very unusual. I think you're going to find, you know, a very thoughtful, intelligent, reflective, serious chef that you may not have had time to notice in the fast-moving world that he's kind of become known in over these last several years. So I should also say that I know a lot of the Rocco story intimately because I had a front row seat to it. Rocco was a client of mine back when I was in the PR and marketing business. He became a friend of mine, and he even put on the wedding party for me and Caitlin at Union Pacific in April of 2000, which amazingly, in just a few weeks, will be 20 years ago. So this is part one of a two-part interview with Rocco. We recorded it a while back before he came back on the New York restaurant scene when he was too busy to record part two. We're actually sitting down during this week to record the second part, so I'm not sure exactly where the conversation will go, but in some fashion, it'll cover his time from Union Pacific Restaurant to the present. And we'll also be discussing a new book that he has coming out on March 3rd, but I'll save the conversation about the book for the part two, which will air closer to the publication date. But this interview will take you from his childhood through his rousing success at Union Pacific. It'll put you back in a time and place in New York dining that was tremendously exciting for everyone who was there. He really epitomized a lot of what was going on at that time, and I can't wait for you to hear it. And please do stick around after the break for my conversation with Scott Verricchio. But in the meantime, this is my conversation with Chef Rocco Dispirito. Here you go.
Andrew Friedman here with Rocco Dispirito.
First of all,
capital S in that last name, just so you know.
Do people not know that? Do you know who's on Instagram, by the way?
No one knows that.
All right, this is the kind of chatter I hate on podcasts.
That's okay.
There's a whole genre of podcasts that I call the hang and name drop podcast.
That's a great kind of podcast.
Where people just hang and name drop.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it just doesn't go anywhere. But there's someone on Instagram, Rocco Cat Spirito.
Rocco Dispirito the cat.
Yeah, who is that?
That's so funny. I don't know who it is. I have no idea who it is.
All of a sudden, they keep like commenting on my posts.
Yeah, so what they're doing is basically trolling everyone I follow or follows me and commenting on everyone's posts. Ann Burrell just sent me a text saying, did you see this?
Yeah.
From Rocco Dispirito the cat?
So yeah.
But
have you looked at the feed? It's just pictures of cats. It's not someone...
No,
it's
a cat named Rocco Dispirito.
But yeah, it's not like it's some person looking to get famous. I think it's just somebody...
No, the intentions are super sweet.
Yeah. I think it's that person just like a tribute.
Whatever, yeah. Whatever. A tribute or not, it's super sweet. I'm an owner of two cats and two dogs, so I'm a big fan. And the fact that someone would name what I believe to be some of the most precious, endearing, lovely animals on the planet, your pets, after me is...
You're good with that.
So, I'm honored. I'm honored, yeah.
Okay.
There's been plenty of dogs named after me, named Rocco and Rocky.
Right.
Very few cats, so I kind of like it. Pets are better than people sometimes, so, you know. These are my two dogs.
Oh, my God. Your screensaver is your dogs.
Yeah,
look,
they're Shiba Inus, and they're lovely dogs.
I think I would be allergic
dogs.
To those dogs.
Oh,
I'm
you need
to
you need a hyper
dogs.
Okay,
yeah.
So you need a hyper.
We're getting a toy Australian Shepherd.
Oh, beautiful!
Which is a mini Aussie, but mini.
Well, they're already small.
It's like the there's Aussies which are about 50 pounds. Then there's mini Aussies which run about 35. These run about 20.
Wow!
Yeah,
is it going to be as nimble and dynamic and agile as a normal Australian
and smart?
Shepherd?
I assume so. Okay, before
it should be
we
playing
become one
frisbee.
Of these, before we become a hanging name drop.
Oh, come on! What's wrong with that?
Let me bring this back to the chef world, Rocco.
Yeah.
You, first of all, I'm seeing you today. You greeted me in a T-shirt. You are as, may I say this as your old friend, you are as fit as ever.
Thank you.
How
wow,
much,
thank
can
you.
I ask
Appreciate
you, how
that.
Much do you work out a day?
You know, I don't work out a lot. I really focus on food.
Really?
Part of what I advocate for is fixing your food first before you go to work out.
Yeah.
You know, as you may or not know, I'm actually a fully employed health coach with lots
that.
Of clients whom I feed on a daily basis.
These are private clients.
Private clients, and I coach on a daily basis. I use small data from their Fitbits and smart scales, so I know what their body mass index is, their fat percent, body fat percent is, or lean muscle mass, sometimes even segmental fat. Like, so I get a lot of data from devices that I supply them with, and it's this 300, 60-degree program. It's fully integrated, food, fitness, and coaching. First thing I tell my clients when they start is do not work out. It will get in the way of your food fixing your problems. The first thing you have to do is detox from sugar. You have to eat the right amount of protein and good for you fat. You have to reduce the amount of empty calorie carbs and replace it with nutrient-dense food. If you don't do that and work out 7 days a week, you're probably not accomplishing your goals unless you're LeBron James, you know? Unless you have that sort of constitution.
Right.
You really need to fix your food first. So the answer to your question is, I'm on my own plan. I get my food delivered to me from my own kitchen every day. I eat it all day long. And I just do some simple plyometrics workouts, pull-ups.
Plyometrics.
And some biking, some cycling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cycling now, what does some mean for you?
It could be 5 days a week, could be one day
a
week.
Yeah, but like how many miles?
Oh, at least to the George Washington Bridge and back, yeah.
Okay, so for people who aren't in New York City, the George Washington, it's about 180th Street, so that's 18.
So imagine the battery.
9 miles each way, so that's about 18,
exactly.
19 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Average speed depends on how many
on a bike.
No, not at all. Yeah. And I've been riding bikes for a while. I used to do triathlons before my back told me to stop.
Yes.
Emphatically, it said, go F yourself if you're going to keep doing this. I'm going to give up. Had back surgery, all that. And so, the triathlon days are over. But, for a triathlon, 50-mile bike rides 5 days a week is normal.
Yes.
But thank you. I appreciate that. But it's really all about food. No grain, no dairy, no sugar.
Well, it's funny because you and I talked about this 8 months ago as we sit here because we had lunch at the Clam.
Right.
And I did not realize
the
depths of your devotion to how you eat because we went there and we ordered some raw bar and you declined the cocktail sauce.
Right.
You remember this? You said, bring me some Tabasco and a lemon
oil.
Wedge. Even olive oil. A lemon wedge and Tabasco. You did not, what's that? Because there's fructose in the
cocktail because there's so much simple
sauce.
Sugars in cocktail sauce. Yeah, the typical cocktail sauce has 15 grams
of
sugar
people,
in that little 2 ounce soufflé.
But even somebody like on Weight Watchers would think like a piece of shrimp and some cocktail sauce is almost like a perfect
snack. That's unfortunate world we live in. There's a lot of misinformation. A lot of people are very confused about what contains sugar. At least people now know to avoid sugar.
Yeah.
But there are hidden sugars everywhere. We've heard this a million times.
Right.
400 names of corn, 400 ways to describe corn syrup. When in doubt, just don't eat it. Make your own sauce.
Okay.
By the way, Tabasco and lemon juice and olive oil is an amazing sauce. It's so delicious.
I want to talk about all this in a minute, but first I want to go back.
Okay.
I want to go back because I think a lot of people don't know your backstory.
Okay.
So when you and I first knew each other.
Yes.
Well, I first met you at a restaurant called Dava.
Yes.
And
my
first
chef shop.
No, but there was another job.
Annabelle was the first chef shop.
Do you know this story?
I think I do. Tell me it again.
I was working for a PR firm.
Right.
And the owner of the firm, David Kratz.
Kratz and Company, yeah.
David had a policy that I really loved. And at the time, this was the top restaurant PR firm in New York. And David
it created a sub-industry of PR, subset
yes,
of PR.
Yes, a lot of people who now have
culinary
their own
PR.
Well, yeah. And a lot of people who now have very well-known agencies started at David's,
yeah.
Or worked for people who started at David's.
And a lot of the very well-known chefs are because of David and you,
yes.
And your friends there.
And colleagues. Yeah. He would not sign a client if we hadn't eaten at the restaurant and felt good about
believed
it.
Believed in the
yeah.
product. Yeah.
So he sends me one night, he goes, this restaurant called Annabelle, where if I'm not mistaken, Terrence Brennan had once been the chef. Late of Picheline. I think he had been the chef there early on.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, okay. I went to eat there, and there were some things on the menu that you later became quite famous for.
Mm-hmm.
The watermelon.
Oh, you remember
and calamari.
Calamari
and, yes,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it must have been right at the change of seasons, because uh-huh. there was also, I want to say maybe a pork dish that had like fried veggie, like... It looked like leaves almost, like fall leaves almost. Anyway, I came in.
I don't remember. I got to look that one up.
I came into work the next day, and I go, David, I don't know who is in the kitchen at that restaurant, but that guy is freaking brilliant.
Wow.
And David goes.
Getting goosies.
And David goes, he just quit this morning.
Oh! Amazing.
Do you remember this?
Oh, my God. No, I didn't know that part.
You didn't know I'd been in the night before.
I remember quitting. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
But it must have been news to the owners because I had come in at their behest the night before. Anyway, then you did Dava.
Right.
Where you started to get recognized. I remember Gail Green wrote some very nice things
Ruth
about
Reichel
you there.
Came into Dava.
Ruth first came in. Yeah. And then that restaurant didn't work out. It was a very weird space. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you remembered this, Rocco, but I was so taken with our early tastings there because construction lasted forever.
Yeah.
That I was just starting to work with Alfred Portale.
Yes.
From the Gotham.
Yes.
Do you remember? I brought him in one night.
I do remember, yes.
And you did a tasting for us.
I do remember.
In a room that was basically plywood walls,
yep.
All the workman stuff pushed to the side.
Yep.
It was that's
like
how
serious
much I
under
knew
construction.
You. That's how high I was on what you were
wow,
up to.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you.
Because that was not a regular occurrence.
Thank you. No, definitely not. I mean, I think there are probably five times in my life where I allowed people to come in before we were open.
Yeah, it was a construction site, and you did a whole tasting for us. And and then you went from there to Union Pacific.
Yeah.
Now, for listeners who were not around, 1998, Union Pacific opens. It is a space that had been CT, which stood for Claude Trois Gros. That's where Laurent Torrendel first got known. He was a Food & Wine Best New Chef there.
That's right.
You opened that restaurant. You were, I don't know, you're going to be modest when I say this, but you were the toast of the town. That restaurant was a big deal. You were doing really inventive, but what I call relatable food. It was super exciting dishes. You got a lot of attention. You were the first chef ever on the cover of Gourmet. That was a famous event. You were holding a fish, right? Weren't you holding a fish?
Tile fish, yeah. It was a tile fish.
So Ruth Reichel put you on the cover of Gourmet.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like a big thing now, but that was not a normal occurrence at Gourmet.
There had never been a chef.
Yeah. They did not
the
put chefs. It was always like lifestyle-y kind of shots.
In fact, she had to, from what I understand, after running into the publisher of Gourmet at the time, a few weeks ago at Aspen Food & Wine, they had a really... fight for it with Cy Newhouse at the editorial meeting.
To put a chef on the cover.
Yep. And she, you know, I remember what he described as a, you know, very tense meeting that got even more tense. And she pulled out the cover and Cy thought about it and said something like, I like it. Let's go with it. And they did. But they also hedged their bet by doing half the publication with a picture of mushrooms.
I thought I remembered that, and I thought I had to be crazy.
No, that was it. That was for sure,
To hedge their bets.
It was a good time. It was a really good time for New York. It was a great time for cooking, for students of cuisine, for the culinary arts. You know, there was an emergence of young American chefs who had done their time either in France or Italy or in the great kitchens of New York City, who were finally coming into their own. Gramsci Tavern opened with Colicchio, and John George had, you know, come into his own. And I like to describe it as the moment when we shifted from the type of cuisine being described by the country you were trying to emulate to the person you were.
Mm.
So, like, Italian and French food became Jean-Georges food and Tom Cliquiot food and Alfred Portali food, and people understood what that meant, right? If we talk about Alfred Portali food,
yeah.
I have a very clear image
totally.
Of what
I
that
used
is.
To yeah. say at that yeah. time, if you put the food of six different chefs in New York in front of me and didn't tell me whose it was, without even taking a bite, I probably could have told you whose was whose.
Yeah. And I think that was the first time in New York City history, maybe in American history, other than perhaps, you know, the West Coast in the 70s and 80s, where that was a thing, right?
Yeah.
Even in the West Coast in the 70s and 80s, which you documented well in your latest book.
Thank you.
Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, everybody. It's on sale everywhere.
I don't ask people to do
this. Would you say that people were known for their food, or were they all trying to cook sort of Italian-inspired, you know, local ingredients?
I think in L.A., before anywhere else, I think the food in L.A., the different chefs were very distinct. I think that it really broke earlier there. I think
so. When they talked about Michael's, they talked about Michael's.
Well, Jonathan
food and,
really, yeah. for years, and Mary Sue and Susan,
yeah, Zuni,
and a guy like Michael, the late Michael Roberts, right. and Wolfgang. Yeah. These people yeah. all had very distinct styles.
But Wolfgang before Spago, he was known for what lingerie or
Ma Maison.
Ma Maison, right.
Yeah.
Ma Maison was more famous than Wolfgang for much of that
yes.
time, right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And then when he went to Spago, I think people...
Yes, it was
yeah, he became
change.
Wolfgang
yeah.
food, yeah.
Yeah, or what he used to say was that he was doing the food that chefs like to eat.
Right.
Pizza,
right.
salad. It's
yeah.
funny, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about how you started cooking. And
sure.
And then, you know, how you ended up in this chapter of your life we're talking about...
Yeah.
Being the kind of chef, that, you know, the latest at the time incarnation of the kind of chef you just described.
It's a real simple start. So as an 11-year-old, I would do errands for homebound elderly women. And
where was this?
This is in Jamaica, Queens, mm-hmm. Sutphin Boulevard, F-stop, you uh-huh. know, for those of you know the area.
Yeah.
So rough place to grow up in the 60s and 70s. And that's how I made money. I did errands and I'd shop for Mrs. Adams and buy her chicken-flavored Triscuits and her M&Ms, and she'd give me $5 and let me keep the change, right? That's how I made money. My mom and dad were Italian immigrants, you know, struggling to make it all work with a big family, and so there wasn't an allowance per se. We didn't have that in my house.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had great food because my mom cooked every day, and my family essentially they moved their Italian lifestyle from Campania to New York City and lived exactly the same way. So we made our own bread, our own tomato sauce on Labor Day, our own wine. We had chicken coops, rabbit hutches, pigeons even sometimes, pheasants sometimes.
You're describing
nuts.
A not unusual Italian-American
that's
situation.
That's true. It really it wasn't. It's not
I've
unusual.
Said we
yeah.
had Tony Montalbano on the show.
Sure.
And we had this conversation that – I'm sorry to interrupt your history.
Okay.
But that, you know – a lot of Americans had to go overseas to discover the
right.
kind of food, everyday
right.
food, and the kind of commitment to good ingredients and homegrown things and all that, that a lot of Italian Americans had right here in the U.S. because they brought it over from the old country.
And the irony is that I think many of us, due to ethnic self-loathing and not being able to speak the language when we went to school and you know, fear of being called out as, you know, Wapsadegos and immigrants. You
Did
know.
That happen to you?
Oh, yeah. I was named Rocco, you know, in 1966. No one was named Rocco. That was
yeah.
a very unusual name back then. So this ethnic self-loathing prevented us from really enjoying and understanding what a treasure that was. So it took me until my 30s before I understood
that was something to be proud of.
My mom, dad, aunts, uncles, grandmother was doing was incredibly special.
So what did
they
at
were
the
so
time
pure
you were
about the food that they ate and the way they lived, and it was a real contadina lifestyle, you know.
So when
a
you
farmer.
Were a kid,
so
it
I was exposed
more
to all
like,
this,
but that all seemed because of the
but I hated
because
it.
Of your context, it seemed like quirky, eccentric, weird.
Yeah, it seemed unsophisticated,
country,
poor people,
right? Country.
Uneducated,
right.
yeah, yeah. And my dad always talked about education, how important it was for us to get an education because he's a, you know, World War II vet, and they only went to third grade at the time in the 50s after the war in Italy was a total disaster. There was no money. There was nothing.
Yeah.
So they came here looking for a better
American
life.
Dream.
And yeah, of course,
yeah.
and they ended up here in the late 50s, and they got their American dream, you know, and they
yeah.
raised three kids, all went to college, and, you know, fulfilled the the reason for coming over. But I hated it and despised it and was made fun of it for it for so many years that I didn't understand I should be really taking advantage of it.
Right.
But luckily I did before they're all gone. And, you know, in my 30s, this is after Union Pacific, actually.
Yeah.
I wrote a book called Rocco's Italian American, all about my experience growing up Italian American. I opened a restaurant called Rocco's to honor that experience, and my mom was the chef there and made the meatballs, and that was all about discovering the treasure that had been my entire life and really beginning to appreciate it. So I was surrounded by one, you know, cuisine and a wonderful lifestyle in terms of the culinary arts, and you know, whether it was homemade or not didn't really matter, for my whole life. And I'm sure that that had a massive impact. So back to the story. 11 years old, making a few bucks a week, doing errands.
Yeah.
I wanted to buy Love Gun by Kiss. My mom thought Kiss were four devils, literally thought they were devils. Come full circle, Paul Stanley actually works with me on my program and loves my mom's meatballs and cooks her meatballs all the time. But his album, Love Gun, prompted me to get a job at 11 in a pizzeria, where I fell in love with the hospitality industry and worked in it ever since. From, you know, every day after that day, I worked for Sal, slicing pizza, pouring fountain soda, opening cans of tomatoes, shredding mozzarella for 50 cents an hour, 60 hours a week that summer, and all the Italian ice I can eat. And I'll never forget the first moment I stood across the counter from a person and cut their pizza properly, saw them smile, handed this, you know, because you didn't want the pizza that was cut, you know, the last one's usually the small one. In Jamaica, you know, people were really looking for value. So if you messed up the slice of pizza, you're in big trouble. And I'll never forget that moment that transpired between me and a random customer that showed me, taught me that this business is almost its transcendence. You know, it's a moment in time where you cause tremendous pleasure if you're doing your job right for another person. So I fell in love with that.
Question.
Yeah.
You're describing a pizzeria.
Right. On Sotfin Boulevard in Queens in the 70s.
Right. But a lot of people who end up cooking.
Yeah.
A, there's what you just described, the reaction of a customer, right? But also there's like an instant love affair with the setting, with the kitchen, with the crew, with all of that.
Yeah.
The hour. Did you take to that immediately?
Without question. I didn't question it at all. I just did the math. I was like, okay, that means 30 bucks at the end of the week.
Right.
That's 10 times what I'm making now. That's amazing.
But did you like being there? Like physically? I love being there. Just feel like you were in the right
place? So I loved being there
for
a couple of reasons. One, Sal was super supportive and a really nice guy and understood I was very young and probably shouldn't have been working. So he let me do fun things like serve Italian ice and out on the street, and I could eat all the blue ice I wanted. Uh-huh. Blue ice was very hard to come by. He'd let me play with his kids across the street in the courtyard. So he was very supportive and treated me like one of his children.
Yep.
So I think it was a big part of it, but there's no question that, you know, the craft of cooking, even though all I was doing was slicing already cooked pizza and shredding mozzarella, that was super compelling to me. Getting that right each time, making sure you didn't mess up and didn't, you know, yield less than they were hoping you'd yield. You know, all those little challenges were just basically captured by imagination, and I fell in love with it. And then I learned that you could cook, not just handle ingredients. And when I learned that at 14, I was done.
Did you start cooking things there?
So no, I wasn't allowed to cook there. I was every once in a while I was allowed to put a pie in the oven. And then the next summer I worked in another pizzeria, and then the next one I worked in a bigger one that had a bigger menu with pastas. And then the summer after that I worked at a big German chop house that did thousands of covers and did like homemade sulza. And that was at 14. I'll never forget the first day I walk in, there's a giant table piled high of pig's heads, all cooked, being picked at for head cheese. I didn't go, I ran to it and said, can I help? And they said, no, you can't touch. You're not allowed to touch this.
You weren't skeeved.
Not at all. Not at all, yeah. You're not allowed to touch. You go to the Garmager where you'll, you know, you'll scoop ice cream and pick parsley and peel shrimp for 2 years before we even let you behind.
They didn't call it Garmager, though.
They call it the cold station, the salad station.
Okay, but Rocco, how do we get from the kind of jobs you're describing to again, like the kind of thing I was talking about at the beginning of the interview. Like you went into a, I don't know what you would call this, even the style of food you did other than your own food, but you went very far away from what we would call traditional Italian American or Italian. You were doing state of the art new American cuisine.
I think it was just an absolute fucking love affair with the craft of cooking and then discovering my internal point of view at some point, right? So years of cooking, listening to other chefs, learning.
I went to the CIA
at 16. I accelerated through high school. I'm getting goosebumps because I'm thinking about how excited I was about food at the time. I took summer school in high school so I could skip a year. Yeah, no, that's right. Absolutely right, yeah. I was literally 16 years old when I graduated. And I went to the CIA as early as I could get in. I think ended up being 17 because back then there was a waiting list. And I did what a great student of cuisine does. I worked for other people. I mostly shut up. I mostly listened. I worked for free. I went to Paris. I lived on the subways. I worked at Cactus Charlie's and made 100 kinds of burgers for money and worked for free at the Hotel Ponce de Galle for 2 years from 18 to 20. In 1986 to 1988.
What chefs captured your imagination?
John George was at 16?
No, well.
Yeah. Waxman? Waxman was one of them. Well, he was on the cover of the Daily News in his kimono.
And I was like 14 at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there was Richard.
For people who don't know, this is a famous shot of Jonathan Waxman. A lot of people say this epitomized the
culture
of the celebrity chef culture. He was on the Sunday Daily News magazine in his silk pajamas in bed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I remember seeing it as a young child. And there was a guy who was Jonathan's Pierre, Richard, someone had a small restaurant in the West Village.
From L.A.?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was Richard Krause.
Richard Krause,
he had a restaurant called Melrose.
Melrose, exactly.
Yeah, he was a Wolfgang Puck protégé.
That dude inspired the heck out of me. You know, obviously, Pepin and Julia Child and Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, were inspirations to me. I loved watching them, especially the Galloping Gourmet, because it was like just unbridled enthusiasm, right? I mean, that dude was so excited about cooking and entertaining people. He was so captivating. I wanted to be just like him, right? I wanted to be as charming, charismatic, and funny. Of course, I'm not, but I got to learn how to cook, I think at least as good as he learned how to cook. So all those people were huge influences. But John George, when I was about 1920, now at Boston University, getting a degree in business, which I also accelerated by doing two summer school programs. So I did a four-year degree in 2 years, two summers.
You went there after the CIA?
I went there after France. Yeah, so I went to the CIA, went to France, and then went to Boston University.
Now, was that a parental influence decision to go get a business degree?
I'll have to admit that my parents, talking about lack of education and coming to America, foreign education was no question a part of it. But I decided a long time ago in my life that I was going to get a full education as much as possible.
Even
in fact,
I want to go
get a PhD in nutrition right now, you know. And if I had the time and all the, you know, I would. Big fan of education. I ended up being a teacher at BU during my time there. I taught the culinary classes, and that's how I paid my tuition because, you know, there was always a lack of funds for all this. So it was just like this incredibly strong love affair with the craft of cooking, the camaraderie, I'm sure a little bit of the, you know, I responded a little bit to the chef's, you know, aggressive managing of us younger cooks because it provided structure. And although it was like borderline violent, it was much less violent than what I was living with on the streets of Queens. Like the streets of Queens were so rough and you were worried about your life and
how rough are we talking? Did you get beat up?
Queens in the '70s, man.
Did you ever get beat up? You ever get mugged?
Beat up, mugged.
You did.
More than that, my mom was in 3 armed bank robberies at Jamaica Savings Bank.
Where she was just in there,
on her knees, hands behind her head.
3 times.
Shotgun pointed at her. Yep. My sister was in a carjacking. I mean, you know, we live with this every day. People broke into our homes constantly. I mean, look up Jamaica, New York, circa 1970.
Yeah, it's hard to people to remember now what New York. New York in the '70s was like in
ultra
desperate need of a
rough
rescue.
So there's a show called The Get Down that describes it perfectly. The Lords of Jamaica are portrayed in the show, and so are some other gangs. You know, the city was ruled by gangs back there, just like the movies, the movie The Warriors.
So here's a weird question. Yeah. When you see a show like that, as bad as it was, that was your childhood, when you see something like that, is it like a post-traumatic stress moment?
No, I now feel nostalgic. Now it's nostalgic, yeah, because I overcame all those, most of those challenges, right? If you overcome it all, then
it's still your childhood.
Yeah, then it's what made me who I am, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, for many of my friends, it made them who they ended up dying with. It made them drug addicts. It made them people who went to jail for murder, theft. A lot of the people who I grew up with didn't end up doing very well.
Yeah.
So for me, a chef yelling at me because I didn't peel a carrot right was nothing. It was just like, okay, that's all you got, bro? Because this guy wants to shoot me or stab me for my milk card. You know, I went to Catholic school. I had a maroon blazer and a check tie. And, like we were targets in that neighborhood. Yeah. There's one Catholic school, Presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and it was written on our tie. I mean, what more do you do to a kid to set
to
him up for
like
being mugged, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It took me years to understand I could fight back, by the way. And I eventually did, and I felt very empowered. And then I went to school and moved the hell out,
I'll tell you off mic who it was, but I know someone who was in class with you at the CIA.
Oh, cool.
And described you as unbelievably intense.
I was.
Do you remember yourself that way?
Oh, yeah. I remember very well.
You wanted to be faster than anybody. You wanted everyone to move out of your way when you were buzzing around the kitchen. This doesn't offend you when I describe this.
No. Yeah. It was offensive behavior, but it was all for a good reason. I was truly
interested. Well, it wasn't described to me as offensive, but it was described as definitely a standout level of
ambition
intensity.
So I did learn in the few years before I went to the CIA that true ambition and service to the craft did pay off and quickly. Like if I peeled those shrimp at that New Hyde Park Inn properly for 2 weeks straight, they'd give me a new job, and that would be a little harder than peeling shrimp. And so it was like chopping onions with the very sharp knives, right? Remember, I'm a child at this point. Right. I shouldn't even be working.
Yeah.
Chopping onions was a privilege, right, that you had to earn. So then after that, it was, making the potato salad, then making the mayonnaise, and then making the tartar sauce. Yes. Now I'm getting into cold sauces, right? And you earn all this by being competent. So learning to be competent and extremely good at whatever you were tasked with was extremely important to me. And at the CIA, it was like, it was 24/7. Competence testing, right?
Yeah.
And at the CIA, they were rewarding good behavior with new projects and good things. And that's probably part of why I love the system, because when you're talking about a rough neighborhood where you're not rewarded for anything, and no matter what you do, you're going to end up in trouble, to a situation where you're eating great food all the time, you're not cold, you're learning, you get to handle knives, but you're not using them on other people. It was such a difference and such an upgrade that it didn't feel hard to me. I think to an average kid who grows up in a privileged life today would feel like a massive downgrade. But for me, it was all upgrade. Not to mention, I'd come home and cook for my family. And when your mom loves what you cook, what's better than that?
Well,
what
were
mom
you cooking at this point?
So I'd come home for Thanksgiving and, do like a Nouvelle version of Thanksgiving, which of course ruined Thanksgiving. I didn't know it at the time, but, I'd make like turkey roulades with, pumpkin velouté and that kind of thing. But this was all part of experimenting with the craft. And what I think was great about what happened to me is that I understood that the craft was really important. I didn't even know your point of view was a thing until it actually bubbled up inside me one day at Grey Kunz's L'Espinasse.
Yes.
I was asked to make a vegetarian dish. No one wanted to make it. I was like, I'll make it. Hey, look at me over here, Grey, chef. And
what do you mean, make one? Come up with one?
Yeah, no one would do it. They were like, oh, vegetarians hate those people. It's, oh, fucking vegetarian.
Was this like a daily, like there was always an offering for off-menu if someone wanted a
veggie
dish?
No, back then, you're talking about the, 1993? We deplored vegetarians. Vegetarians were the scum of the earth back then, right? We didn't give them any respect.
The
no
ass.
One wanted to cook for them. Yeah. Even Chef Kunz, one of the greatest people and most inventive minds I've ever seen in the kitchen, handed it off to a Comey in the Entremetier station. And I came up with a dish, and they all made fun of me. Scott Bryant, more than anyone, made fun of me so much. He's another great chef from my time. But it ended up in the 3-star review. The dish was mentioned in the review as being an outstanding dish. And, you know, that's a, for a 20-something-year-old chef,
yeah,
it's a perfect case study in work hard, love the craft. You have an opportunity to express your point of view and yep. blend it with the craft. That's when you elevate cooking from a craft to an art form. And then someone actually in the press recognized it.
Yeah.
And the customer loved it. So more important than anything, the customer loved it.
Well, we should also say, because he's not been in the game in New York, in a big city for a long time, Greg Kuntz was one of the great chefs of this era you're talking about. Yeah. He was at L'Espinasse at the St. Regis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was an opulent
yes.
beyond.
Beyond to me, the beyond.
That was about as opulent as it got.
Yeah, like, that was a moment in time.
It was like
yeah.
walking into another era.
Versailles.
When you walked in. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The largest gold... plated ceiling project in history.
Yeah.
They spent gazillions. He was the first to have a Bonnet suite
yeah.
of stoves in New York. Yeah, that was amazing. I worked there on several stations, learned a lot. But, you know, I was in my 20s, and at this point I've been cooking for over 10 years, I would say, you know.
Yeah.
And my point of view emerged. Yeah, and a lot of it was due to Kuntz showing us how widely you can think about ingredients, because he was so imaginative.
Yeah, he would bring in like Asian influence,
yeah,
and but also
yeah.
just rock solid classic French
right.
technique
yeah.
and fundamentals.
He's a perfect example of a guy who mastered his craft at Freddy Girardet, who was also an inspiration of
right.
mine. I wrote to Freddy Girardet so many times. So this whole time, I'm writing to the best chefs of the world,
yeah.
trying to get stages and internships. Getting, you know, no. Mama's Own said no. When I met Wolfgang, I remember saying to him, you didn't take me. I did it to Jonathan Waxman, too, and a few other guys. But I ended up working for Kuntz and trailing at a bunch of great places,
yeah.
you know, Boulay and Le Bernardin. And when I say trail, I'm talking about a free internship. This is not a job, because I know people are very touchy about this subject.
A stage, though.
When
you don't mean
yeah.
a trail, you mean a stage.
A stage, yeah.
yeah. You were there for
yeah, brief
several
periods,
days or a
yeah,
couple
yeah.
weeks.
Or weeks, or yeah. Yeah, depending on which one.
So... okay, we're going to run out of time here.
I know.
This might, we
we'll
might
pick
have,
up.
Maybe we'll make this a two-parter. So before we end for today,
yeah.
bring me up to Union Pacific, because again,
yeah.
I have said this about you. I have referred to you in conversation, you know, because I did this book, so I've been talking a lot about chef history, and I have referred to, in my mind, at least in terms of New York City, I refer to you as the last chef of the 90s.
Wow.
Do you know what I, you look like you know what I mean by
I think
that.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Well, I mean you were
Tell
me the
mean.
Last of
yeah.
these guys
yeah.
and women who I associate with what you were describing earlier in this interview. You know, Pina Luongo once said to me, back in those in the 90s, there wasn't this homogenization of food. It was like, I'm going to go here and eat John George food. I'm going to go here and eat Alfred Portelli food. I'm going to go here and eat Jonathan Wack. Like, those, when you made those decisions,
yeah.
those were like genres unto
yeah.
themselves.
Yeah.
And I feel like... your food was in a... because you'll go now and read articles about like 2000... some, you know,
yeah.
New York Magazine a couple of years ago, Grub Street did a piece on 2004,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the Dave, you know, the Changification and Spotted Pigification of cuisine, right? Those two restaurants came around in that
right.
year.
Right.
And people talk about how that changed things,
mm-hmm.
right? But that was a casualizing of the dining experience. Mm-hmm. It was a...
familiar foods,
more
not, necessarily
familiar, not
necessarily
going out on a
limb
a lot
for
of
every
technique,
dish. Yeah,
not,
yeah.
what my late
yeah.
friend Joshua Zersky called tweezer food.
Yeah.
And I feel like you coming along 98,
yeah.
right at the end of that decade at Union Pacific, doing what you did, which was super successful, but very audacious. And sometimes in its simplicity.
Yeah.
I mean, you were known for a dish. It was Taylor Bay scallops.
Four ingredients, yeah.
Taylor Bay scallops.
A bay scallop,
tomato water, mustard oil.
And
what's
uni.
The fourth?
Uni.
Oh, and the uni.
Yeah.
Right. That was so simple. But I can still taste it. I can still see it. I can still, I mean.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's one of the dishes I feel is a truly original dish to me because, you know, everyone's influence, of course, finds its way into your hands
sure.
and food. But I feel that dish was a result of a lot of testing and tasting and working and working the ingredients. And it's also the epitome of what I feel a great dish should do, which is have a story, a beginning, middle, and an end. You know, you taste it, there's a crescendo, there's a resolution. I'm very proud of that dish, and I hope to have the opportunity to bring that dish back to the world someday.
But that to me, you know, I mentioned this other. It was the what was it? It was calamari, watermelon,
yes.
and cilantro.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I'm talking now.
Yeah.
This is 20 years later today,
yeah.
as we sit
yeah.
here, and I remember these things coming out of the kitchen.
Yeah. Well, we had permission back then. We were able. It was a perfect storm, right? We young, ambitious chefs who could make a convincing case for allowing us to be ambitious. A New York City dining scene that craved ambition and wanted unusual and wanted to go out on the limb with you. And the Union Pacific was like my one-man show at the Walter Kerr Theater. You know, it was literally...
But people wanted that. Yeah. And you were able to do a menu that was... I mean, as I remember it, it was mostly... You know,
raw seafood and...
You didn't have, like, what would it be... What would the... At that time, what would be the equivalent of, like, the avocado toast or the kale salad? Like, the goat cheese.
The goat cheese feta.
You didn't
feta.
Have the goat cheese with the...
The watermelon feta salad or the
watermelon feta
goat cheese beet walnut
salad.
Cheese
beet walnut. Yeah, you didn't do those.
Yeah.
You didn't have to.
No, I worked hard to try not to do what was
you
already being
done. You
didn't
have to do those, you know? And that's what I mean when I say the last chef of the 90s, because there was an audience that was... It was like a theatrical thing. They wanted to come see the Rocco Show. Did it feel like that?
Not at the time, but now I looking back, I feel like it was my one. I feel like I had a one man show on Broadway for 10 years. Yeah.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to keep the mid-show break very short this week. I told you most of what's going on at the top of the show. I do, however, want to briefly remind you that I will be back on the road a little bit this late winter and early spring. I will be speaking to the culinary historians of Washington, D.C., on the afternoon of Sunday, March 8th. That's actually in Bethesda, Maryland, but it is the Culinary Historians of Washington, D.C. And I will be hosting a few panels at the Chef's Rolls second annual anti-convention in San Diego, California on April 6th and 7th. If you visit the appearances page at andrewtalkstochefs.com, you can find links to tickets and information for both. And I think that's it. So our second guest today is Scott Verrecchio. Scott is the chef and owner of Citrus Grill House Restaurant in Vero Beach, Florida. Scott is a chef who I got to know when he was in New York City working for several years under Chef Tom Valenti, who had restaurants like West and Cheska, and who currently is the chef and owner of Oxbow Tavern in Manhattan. Scott was a career changer who eventually moved down to Vero Beach in my home state of Florida. While I was down there this fall, I paid him a visit. We keep his backstory pretty short in this conversation, just enough to really give you a sense of who he is and where he came from, and focus mainly on a harrowing 2 years that he recently went through, recovering from a fire that destroyed his restaurant. I say destroyed, it was rebuilt, but the day of the fire, it was essentially a ruin. He talks about getting through that ordeal and the lessons learned from it. And he also talks about how he made the best of the situation. And I think this is amazing. At age 59, stodging at restaurants like the French Laundry and 11 Madison Park, which is in many ways remarkable, A, that he got those stodges and did them, and B, that he did it at his age. Although he's a very fit 59, that is far from a normal age for somebody, you know, spending unpaid time learning in kitchens. And it's really fascinating to hear him talk about why he did that and what the experience was like. Like I said before, Scott is an old friend of mine. He's just a great guy. I think the way he dealt with adversity from 2008 through 2009 was really admirable. And I think you'll get a sense of all that from hearing him describe it. So with that, here you go. This is my conversation with Scott Verrecchio of Citrus Grill House Restaurant in Vero Beach, Florida. I hope you enjoy it. We are, I don't know if people can tell what this noise is in the background. We are within spitting distance of the ocean.
We are.
We are outside your restaurant.
Mm-hmm. On the veranda.
We are in Vero Beach, Florida. We are at the Citrus Grill House, and we're with my old friend from New York, Scott Verrecchio. Hello, Scott.
Andrew, it is an honor to have you here in Vero Beach.
Oh, thank you
very much.
Very
much so. Good to see old friends.
You and I know each other. This is your restaurant.
It is.
How long have you been here now?
We will be 10 years in March.
But you and I knew each other from formative times in both our lives. We met when I was just transitioning from a very unhappy restaurant PR marketing guy
yep.
into being a writer. One of the people I was writing with or for, collaborating with, was Chef Tom Valenti in New York City.
I think it was his first book.
Yeah, all three of his books.
Yeah. But that's when we met.
We met when Tom and I were doing the first book called Welcome to My Kitchen. And you were, I don't know what to even describe you as, your relationship with Tom. But you had switched careers.
Tom and I grew up together.
Yeah.
In Ithaca, New York.
Yes.
Played some competitive hockey against one another as teenagers.
Yes.
And went our own ways. You know, he finished high school and he went right to, right to France.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't see each other for years. I took up, this is my third career. So first it was golf. I was going to be the next Jack Nicklaus. That did not happen.
What happened to that?
I decided I wanted to learn how to ride a motorcycle. And one of the guys that worked in the club had a small little Honda. And he said, do this, do this, do this. So I got on the bike, and I was riding around the maintenance area of the golf course. And it was sandy, and I didn't know how to stop it correctly, and I hit a tree. And I did a fair amount of damage to the left side of my body, so much so that I couldn't play competitive golf anymore.
I never knew this part of your story.
Yep.
Wow.
And
but you think you were good enough that you might have...
I was going to try to make Q school. Mm-hmm. Q school is the qualifying school that you attempt to make the tour on.
Okay.
And once I hurt myself in that manner, that went away. And I needed to change jobs. So I called a friend of mine who I admired very much. And actually his mentor in business school also was Danny Meyer's mentor in business school, Hal Bierman at Cornell University.
Yeah.
And I said, listen, I'm lost. I don't know what I'm doing here. He goes, listen, come up to New Jersey. I'll put you to work in my company, and we'll see what happens. So this was a manufacturing and engineering company in Linden, New Jersey, near the Newark Airport. And we made hose products. I know that sounds odd, but if you want to take anything from point A to point B, that's what we did. And I stayed there for 12 years, and I made good money.
Yeah.
And I liked it, and I had weekends off.
Right.
And holidays off.
Yeah.
Then I decided one day, I don't like it. You know, you hear that old adage, if you get up in the morning and you say that you have to go to work, find something new to do.
Yeah.
I found something new to do. So Tom, at this point, Tom Valenti, had become chef and co-owner of Cascabel on Lafayette Street.
Yeah, Cascabel was a restaurant on Lafayette Street in Soho, New York. It is now the home of Michael White's restaurant, Osteria Morini.
Correct. Yes. And way back in the day, Geraldine Ferraro.
Yeah.
She was the co-owner.
Yes. Her son, John Zaccaro, owned that restaurant.
Yes. Yeah. And so I called Tom up one day. I said, hey, I want to come in the city and talk to you. I think I want to cook. He's like, okay. So I went into the city. I was living in New Jersey. And I remember it was a cold, rainy December day. I had on this stupid-looking trench coat. I thought I looked cool. I really didn't. And I said, I'm going to go to culinary school. And he said, you're out of your mind. He said, you're absolutely out of your mind. You're going to go from making a good salary to start paying for school, and you're 37 years old. You're changing your career at 37 years old. He said, here's what you're going to do. You're going to come in here on the weekends and hang out in the kitchen. Peel carrots, cut onions, clean lobsters, whatever it is my guys tell you to do. And in 6 months, see if you like it. And then we'll make a decision. So those 6 months turned into 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent
Of weekends.
I spent 2 years doing whatever they needed me to do in the kitchen. It got to the point where I could work a pastry station. I was making staff meal. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I said, I'm changing careers. And the pastry chef at that point in time, someone who you've done a podcast with, Lincoln Carson,
mm-hmm.
was the pastry chef there. And he had just accepted the position of head pastry chef at La Côte Basque. And he asked if I'd join him. And guys like me who have never worked in a restaurant like that before. You know, that's simply a matter of who I knew, not what I knew, because I didn't know how, I didn't know anything about Le Côte Basque. Mm-hmm. Didn't realize how formal it was, how important it was. Didn't know anything about Rachou.
Well, I should say a lot of people probably don't. So I should say Le Côte Basque was a very important restaurant historically in New York. Jean-Jacques Rachou was the chef. And its significance, I think it's mostly significant because it was one of the few places in the early 80s of French ownership with a French chef that was willing to hire Americans.
American cooks,
very famous guys, mostly guys.
Charlie Palmer came out of there.
Rick Moonen, yep. Frank Crispo, Todd English did a turn there. Like a lot of
Henry Meir.
Yeah, a lot of people who became very big chefs got either their first or second jobs ever in that restaurant at a time when it was very hard for an American to get into a French restaurant. So anyway, that's the history.
So I got the job at Le Côte as a pastry assistant. And I remember I was living in Summit, New Jersey. And I was working 6 days a week. I had Wednesdays off, about 60 hours, which wasn't horrible. And I got my first paycheck, and it was $195 net. And I said to myself, oh, I've made a huge mistake here.
Yeah.
And so I called my old boss at the manufacturing company and said, listen, what do I do? He said, you got one day off, right? Come work for me on Wednesdays. You'll make more money here in a day than you will at the restaurant in 6 days, and it'll help you out. And it did. It kept me solvent. It kept me in the game. Mm-hmm. And I'm very thankful for that. Even after I had left his employ, he was helping me any way that he could. And he still helps me today with business problems and things of that nature. He's a lifelong friend. And it was the start of what I do now, my third and final career.
Well, so I met you, I mean, when...
I met you in 2000.
Yeah, but you were, I mean, for years, you. I don't know what I would describe what you did for Tom, because you were there in the mornings a lot. You kind of honchoed. How do we describe what your role was? Because you guys were together for years.
I was his daytime sous. I was whatever he needed me to be,
yeah.
Basically.
If you guys had an out-of-house event, you kind of honchoed that.
Yeah, I did whatever Tom needed.
You know, it's interesting, Scott. This feels to me like accidentally because of what you went through, which I want to talk about if we could, in the last year and a half. You've had a couple of moments in your life where you did things by choice in the story you just told, and then not so much by choice, although I think you made the best of a bad situation in some ways over the last year. You had a fire here last year.
We did. We had a bad fire. We lost everything.
Yeah. So we're sitting here. I have to say, let me paint the scene for people. We're here. We're right on the beach in Vero Beach. You can hear the waves crashing on the shore. We're here sort of between lunch and dinner. We have the veranda to ourselves. The Citrus Grill House is like I said, we're a stone's throw from the water. You have a very pretty dining room on the other side of the doors that we're sitting at right now. You have an open kitchen or a...
It's an open kitchen, yeah.
Visible kitchen.
Same, that idea came from West's kitchen.
And then outside on the veranda here, there's a second bar and seating outdoors. I mean, you would never know to look at the place. They did a great job. I remember at the time you telling me, fortunately, you had excellent insurance for what you went through.
Which is important. You know, I can't tell business owners enough to make sure you have enough insurance. Mm-hmm. That is, and good insurance.
Yeah.
And business interruption insurance.
Yeah.
That is the most important thing. You know, without that, we would not be here now.
Yeah. So what happened? I remember I was actually in Florida promoting my book by coincidence, and I got a text from you. Early in the morning.
Very early.
Saying, I mean, it was personal, but you were obviously beside yourself. But tell the story of what happened.
Tuesday, March 27th, around 5 in the morning, my phone rings, which is a little early, and it's one of the residents here in the building. He just said, Scott, there's a fire here.
There's condos upstairs.
There's 12 of them, yes. Yeah. He said, there's a fire. And I put on whatever clothes was closest to the bed, and I drove here as quick as I could, and the firemen were not here yet, and I was the first person here. I tried to go in the back door, and I couldn't, because when I opened that back door, you've heard of that term, backdraft?
Yeah.
It created a vortex or a suction, and just hot embers came flying at me and were hitting me, so I quickly closed the door, and I went around to the front door, hoping it would be different, and It was. And so I was able to go into the kitchen, and it was just, it smelled, the fire had been put out, but I don't know.
By the sprinkler system?
No, it burned itself out. The sprinkler system didn't get it done. The sprinkler system wasn't strong enough. So it was basically, it was a waterfall inside of the restaurant because the water risers for the building had melted due to the heat. And it was just, as I showed you the video today, it was just a waterfall of restaurant coming in from the ceiling. And the fire was contained to the hood system, and the fire was an accident. Each night at the end of service, we empty our fryer that we do French fries in, put it in a large stock pot and put it up on the stove. We strain it and cool it. But one of the guys at night, when he was cleaning the stove, must have swiped and hit the flame on underneath the pot. And the diameter of the flame is, say, 6 inches. And the pot is 18 inches across, and he couldn't see it. And they walked out with a pot of oil on, you know, with a flame underneath it. And
industrial strength flame.
Yeah. And it exploded. And the hood system did its job by containing the flames. Flames did not breach there. But the smoke and the water did. And the heat radiated out and melted everything.
The pipes.
The pipes, the ceiling, the wood, it just melted it.
I remember you telling me even that morning, I think it had to just be by text. I don't think we spoke.
I don't think we spoke.
That it was mostly water damage. And you just showed me today when I got here, drove up from Miami this morning, and you showed me on your phone the video you took that morning. It's like the Titanic, just like
flooding in,
like hurricane amounts of water just flooding in through the ceiling
for hours.
Yeah,
for hours. And you know, I was told that for the first 4 or 5 days after the fire, I was quote unquote in a catatonic state, and I can see that because everything that you know, everything that you do, has been removed.
Yeah,
your purpose.
Yep.
Your customers,
yeah.
Your employees,
yeah.
Your business—it's been taken away from you by something that you didn't do,
yeah.
And coming to terms with that, and it was the busiest week of the year. It was Easter week, and so, you know, we were making cash hands over fist, and then it's gone,
yeah.
Boom,
yeah.
And it took a while to understand. It's going to take a while. You know, I thought, oh, no problem. It's cosmetic. We can get this done. Well, within a day, we knew that it was a total build-out. Every light fixture, every conduit cable, every plumbing, anything that was in this building had to go. And it was so bad. This floor is a 12-inch thick mono slab. The parts of the floor had to be cut out because they were so wet you couldn't legally rebuild on them. We're talking 12-inch by 12-inch pieces of concrete that weigh 300 pounds had to be cut out one by one. It was nothing I wish upon anybody.
Do you find it amazing how, I mean, if you think about it, in some respects, it's probably remarkable that it doesn't happen more often because, you know, restaurants are in the business of fire, right? There's fire in kitchens. But
fire and oil.
But there are given how many safeguards we have, right, that does happen. I mean, there have been some very high-profile fires. David Kinch at Manresa has had two.
Smith and Walensky had one. And Kinch was an accident.
Charlie Trotter, at one point in his life, was going to be part of the restaurants at Time Warner Center in New York, and there was a fire.
There was a fire.
And, then he, I guess, I don't know what the story is, but that created the opportunity to change his mind. Per Se had a fire right at the very beginning in that same building.
Butterfield 81 had a fire, too. Mother's Day a number of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it is amazing how often it does happen.
I guess having gone through it, I can understand. I mean, ours was avoidable. Ours was an accident. It was like it was intentional.
Right.
But, you know, and it is so... It changes you so much. One of the things that we do here, you know... I think by now I'm a fairly good cook, but one of the things that we're known for is a truffle French fry. It's very simple truffle French fry. And it got to a point where I said to myself, you know, being proactive moving forward, I'm not putting in a fryer. Because if you think about a fryer, it's nothing more than a metal drum filled with oil and a big flame underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an accident waiting to happen. And so I I questioned a bunch of potential, not potential, I questioned a bunch of customers saying, hey, listen, when we reopen, I'm not going to do French fries. And they said, we're not coming. And they were serious. I'm like, really? And so lo and behold, we have a fryer in there. Yes. Because
customer's always right.
I will say, you know, I don't use truffle oil on these French fries. I use butter from Italy, and they're special good, as you'll taste later tonight.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to dinner.
But, you know, it was the best choice I've made in life was to become a cook. Because it gives me the most happiness. You know, I think in general, a cook wants to do nothing more than to nurture and to make somebody happy, you know, put your arms around them. I'll never be a wealthy man doing this. But the compensation that you get from the guests and the customers and saying, this was amazing, so glad you reopened, you can't pay for that. Mm-hmm. We've had people doing tours of Florida looking to see where they're going to relocate, for northerners, whether it's Miami, West Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, wherever. And five or six people ate here when they toured Vero Beach and say, we're choosing here because of this restaurant. You can't pay for that.
No.
But I've been very, very fortunate as to where I've worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, working for Tom was great. That led me to work for Lincoln Carson, you know, in New York and in Las Vegas also at Picasso, in the Bellagio. And, you know, I was a late bloomer.
Yeah. Well, this gets to, so here's what I wanted to talk about, right? You go into a kitchen at 37. That's unusual. I mean, people do it. Mm-hmm. It does happen. I had a couple of career changers on the show in the past because I think it's fascinating that somebody feels, for whatever reason, a calling strongly enough to take that leap. That is a big thing to do, especially in this profession that you've chosen because it is so physical.
It's hard.
I walked in today and you know, we don't need to say your age, but, you know, many years on from 37, you know, you were standing there butchering fish when I walked in today.
You know, I'm still lucky. I still get to do what I like.
Yeah,
I do.
And no, I get it.
That's a big part of it.
This is still a physical thing.
It is. And, you know, my body's banged up, as you know. And so it's not the easiest thing to do it every day because I still work. I work every day.
Yeah.
Every single day. I think I told you that since last March, I've taken 5 days off and now it's just been... Yeah. You know, do fun stuff with my son.
Yeah.
But other than that, I work every day.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Yeah. So you, during part of this time when your baby down here was being rebuilt, right, you did some things. This is also, you know, if it was unusual at 37, at your current age,
I'm 59.
You're 59. So you did some stages.
I did, you know. One thing that I didn't want to do is I had all intentions of when we reopened, have this place be beautiful, better looking than it was before, and it was good looking before. And if I were to put the same menu down, that would be a fail to me.
Yeah.
They would say, what has he done this whole year? He hasn't done anything.
Yeah.
It's the same menu from a year ago.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, I want to up my game. I want to learn from the best. And so I did a stage with Thomas Keller, French Laundry, which was... great. I spent 17 days out in Napa in San Francisco.
How many days of that was at the laundry?
Five. And it was late September, so it was harvest season. It was beautiful. It rejuvenated my career in the sense that I got to see this whole other side of the food world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, walking through Central Valley where all of the produce is grown, or spending time with some winemakers going, you know, as they pick, even the garden at the French Laundry alone is inspiring.
Well, they call it the garden, but for people who haven't been there, I always find that so charmingly, you know, it's a farm.
Yeah,
it's basically a farm across the street from the French Laundry.
It's a well-manicured farm.
With a giant hoop house.
It's like the Versailles of gardens.
Yeah, I mean, it's cute that they call it the garden. I think that's Thomas trying to be somewhat modest about it.
What I like about it the most is on the backside of the garden, there's a little 80-yard golf hole with green and a tee, and he goes back there and he, you know, hits it up. And it's great.
But tell me, going in there at age 59, okay, first of all, how'd you get the gig?
Each year, I go to the restaurant show in Chicago, and he represents Heston cookware and Heston stoves and grills and such. So he always does something at the show. So I knew he was going to be there. And the year before, I saw him. He was staying in the same hotel we were staying in. And I was assuming, you know, maybe he'll be in the same hotel this year. So on a random Sunday, myself and one of my investors was at the bar in the hotel. I was dressed nicely, had on a blazer, a tie. We had just come to dinner. And earlier that day, I hand wrote a letter explaining my circumstances to Chef Keller. So, you know, we've kind of met each other a couple of times. We have some mutual friends. He invited one of his good friends to the opening, to the friends and family opening of Per Se. I went along with that dinner. And when we were opening Cheska,
another Tom Valenti project
in New York City, he would come and bring some of his crew to Cheska for dinner a little bit. So we had, you know, the 6 degrees of separation. And I hand wrote him a letter, and I had the concierge put it in his room. And a month later, I get an email from one of his sous chefs
inviting you to come to a stage.
You're welcome. Come out as, you know, whenever you want, as many days as you want. And he was there the whole time and could not have been nicer.
That's great.
Just could not have been nicer. And, you know, the one thing that I came away from my time there is the level of respect in that kitchen. From head chef to chef de cuisine down to dishwasher, everybody is called chef. Everybody in that kitchen. And it empowers you. And I tell that to my staff all the time. And I was, I mean, granted, the kitchen was meticulous and the food is just remarkable. But the respect that he has for his staff was, it left a big mark on me. And I love that.
What kind of stuff did they have you do there?
The first thing I think was a test. They gave me about 150 pearl onions, and they said they wanted the middle cup. There's like three layers to a to a pearl onion. So take the outside shell off and the inside out, and we need like 300 of these little tiny pearl onion cups, and they're going to put a little bit of jus of some sort in it. I'm like, all right, I got it done. And then I worked a station. I was plating food.
Oh, you worked during service?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was, the shift was one-to-one. Once service stopped, they didn't make me clean, so I left at about 10, which was nice. But those guys work. Those guys work hard, harder than most people think, and utmost respect to what they do and how they do it and do it for so long.
Yeah.
And I am very blessed to spend my time there.
And what did you take? What was the takeaway? I mean, you've been cooking a long time. You've been an owner for a decade. What did you get out of that?
I think it was the respect he has for his staff. And, you know, what's funny is when I was at Picasso, Julian Serrano was the chef there, and he had cooks from all over the world that came to work there. I was a New Yorker living out there.
Yeah.
Every single day, every day, he would go around to each cook. Hey, you know, he knew I liked the Yankees. Hey, how'd the Yankees do? Or, how's your friend back in New York? And he would make a point of talking to every single person and letting them know how important that they are to him.
Yeah.
And the same type of mindset and mantra I pulled out from Thomas Keller. And what is nice is, granted, we've been open here almost 10 years now, but every night when I leave here, I go to every single employee and thank them. Just even if it's a quick tap on the shoulder and thank you if they're talking to a customer, I just acknowledge that. And I think that's important, you know, because your staff, they make who you are.
Yeah.
Without your staff, you're nothing. Yes, I might be the face of the restaurant, but together we're a team.
Yeah.
We're a football team. I'm the quarterback, but you need a lineman and a running back and a wide receiver.
Yeah, sure.
And I thank my staff, and I think I'm good to them. And because of that, I've got people that have been here all 10 years I've been open.
Yeah. So you did that. And then on the other coast, I know you spent a couple of days at 11 Madison Park.
I spent the same thing, thanks to you. And then you're the only reason.
I wasn't fishing for that, but.
You're the only reason why I got in there. And what was nice is before I went, there was a Netflix documentary called 7 Days Out.
Yep.
And it was. It
must have been right before you went.
It was just before.
Yeah.
And I probably watched it 20 nights in a row. I kid you not. I just wanted to immerse myself as much as I could into how they do things. And it's the same type of thing. Just Daniel Hume was not there. They were doing their pop-up in Aspen at the time because I was there.
The Winter House.
I was there in January.
Yeah.
But Brian Lockwood, the chef de cuisine, was just fantastic. Just as nice as can be, driven. You know, he leads the brigade very, very well. And the same type of system. They respect everybody. And it was great.
How did they treat you in these two kitchens? I mean, someone of your...
As an equal.
It wasn't awkward being like an older guy there. You're a youthful 59. Nobody would put you at 59.
Agree.
Yeah, you still got your hair. Most of it's still black.
Yes. No, I think
trim.
I'm in decent shape.
Yeah.
I was an equal.
Yeah.
I was a cook.
Yeah.
I think they had heard a little bit about my story and what we were doing here, and they were all very respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that, very nice. And then the one other thing that I also did is I spent some time with Val Rona at their Brooklyn studios doing chocolate boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the instructor was Lincoln Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you don't think about it, but I'll probably never have this much time off again until either I retire or die.
Yeah.
And I tried to make the most of it.
Yeah.
I did a fair amount of dinner parties at my house. I would invite four people, and I would have a server or one of my managers come, and they would have no say. I would do four or five courses, and I did 20 or 30 of these, recipe testing for the new menu, just trying to get ideas, feedback, people's likes, dislikes, ease of pickup, you know. And I tried to keep as busy as I could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the best things about having a fire is I have, you know, at the time, a 9-year-old son. So we got to spend an enormous amount of time together, which was very nice. As any chef knows, male or female, if you have a child, you don't spend a lot of time with that person. And that's the hardest part about this job is, you know, he's 10. He was born when the restaurant opened.
Mm-hmm.
And you get snippets of his life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't get him daily.
Yeah.
But he's a good kid, and you know, he frightens me because he can come here, he'll put on an apron, and he'll go in the back, and he can plate four dishes, soup to nuts, and send them out, and they'll be perfect. And he's 10 years old.
Wow. Do you think, does he want to maybe do this?
I hope not. I hope not. He loves it.
Now, why do you hope not?
Because I don't want, it's a hard life.
Yeah.
It's a hard life. You know, it's hard physically, it's hard on a family, hard on a spouse.
Yeah.
It's rewarding in the sense in that, you know, the guests can be great.
Yeah.
And they make you feel like you're the most important person in their life. And some guests, not so great, any chef knows. But it's a hard life. I would rather him be the shortstop for the Yankees than be a cook.
So listen, this is all we're talking about the very sort of the silver lining parts of the fire, you know, the fact that you used the time in this very wild. I remember you telling me you were going to go out and stage at the French Laundry, and my initial reaction was, wow, that's really unusual. And then I thought, that's amazing. Like, why wouldn't you do that?
You never stop learning.
Yeah. No. Well, one of my favorite feelings as an adult is learn, like I've mentioned it on the air, I'm learning guitar right now for the first time in my life.
That's awesome.
Now, I love guitar, actually, if I'm honest, has been frustrating because I'm having a hard time. But I do love that feeling of being a student, of being a learner, of humbling yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And saying, I'm going to take X on. You know, I do love that. When I quit my old day job and decided I was going to write full time, about food, do cookbooks, which I did for a number of years. First thing I did was went and signed up for a course at what used to be called the French Culinary Institute, which is now the International Culinary Center. And I loved going in there on Saturday with my toolkit and just learning. I loved learning. I loved being a little dumb about something.
No, I get it. I get it. You know, I got my first taste of this business in 85, 85 or 86 when I was bartending at Sign of the Dove.
Oh, my God. That's another old restaurant in New York City.
Yeah. And I was like, this is a real important restaurant. You know, there's that person over there, and, you know, there's the mayor there. And I kind of liked it, not knowing I was going to go into it.
Yeah.
But that was my first foray into into fine dining. And I was like, this is something new and different for me.
Yeah. So what I was going to say a minute ago is, you know, I love that feeling, and you know, explained the silver lining part. But what was the nadir? What was the low point? I mean, you were out of the, you had no restaurant for a long time. Your place was a ruin.
Dealing, and this goes back to knowing as much as you can. Understanding insurance is incredibly important in this business, and I didn't understand it that well, but thank goodness I had some investors that understood it very well. But dealing with insurance companies, it will break you down. It is harder than you think.
You mean filing a claim, doing it the right
whole
way?
Process getting, you know, we do everything above board. You know, I couldn't do anything that's wrong or illegal or off-color, gray, whatever you want to call it. But dealing with the insurance company is the hardest thing I think I've ever had to do.
Because of the endurance it required?
They wear you down. They just wear you down. You know, in today's day and age now, this is an electronic world nowadays. Money gets transferred by wire electronically. They would take a check from the USA, mail it to London, get it signed, mail it back to New York City, get it signed, mail it to Parsippany, New Jersey, get it signed off on, mail it to me. And that process would take 8 to 10 weeks.
Mm.
After they said, we cut the check. Okay, so January 1st, you cut the check. I'm not getting that check till mid-March. And it's just frustrating because you've got contractors you have to pay. You've got your vendors that, you know, when you went out on a certain day, you still owed all this money to. They want to be paid. And it is a slow and torturous death to some people. And I almost think that it's how they work that game.
Mm-hmm.
That was very difficult, very difficult. I knew that we would reopen, but not having anything to do all day and all night for months on end was hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're so used to doing something for 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And then when that's gone, like, what do you do?
Yeah.
So I watched a lot of YouTube.
Okay.
You know, years ago, and you might get mad at me, this is, you're such a great cookbook writer. Years ago, if you wanted to learn about a restaurant, you had to buy the book.
Right.
You don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
There's so much information online.
It's like, I haven't written a cookbook in 5 years. It's okay.
There's so much information and videos and tutorials and ideas online that you can school yourself right there.
Yeah, which is a great thing.
So I spent a lot of time doing that, learning about as much stuff as I could. And I absolutely fell in love with Arpège in Paris, Alain Passard.
Mm-hmm.
I just love what he is doing over there. And I probably watched his video 15 or 20 times on Netflix called Chef's Table France.
Okay.
And it explains his transformation from serving proteins.
Yeah.
To going to all vegetable menus.
Yeah.
And how they filmed the documentary and the showing him in the kitchen. It was just inspiring.
That's
and
great.
It made me want to get back in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Bad. And so I think that next summer, that's one of my destinations. I want to go to Arpège, even if I go by myself.
Nice.
Because it meant so much to me this year because that was a positive.
Yeah.
I had a positive in my life. Just watching this man cook.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you, you know, we're sitting here at the ocean, you know, we hear it rolling in. Now we're sitting on the veranda of your restaurant. You know, the beach is great, right? But
mm-hmm.
I think at a downtime in your life, it could probably have the opposite feeling. I would think being here without a restaurant in this setting, you could really start to feel insignificant.
What was hard is a lot of the hardware and stuff from the fire we put out here on the veranda.
Oh.
And it was covered in ash and dirt and soot and smoke. And it was just like the bathroom fixtures were out here and lights and speakers. And it was just like, you know, when you see a hurricane and there's just a pile of crap afterwards. And it was like, this is just depressing.
Yeah.
And then when you find a contractor, then you find an architect, and little by little, there's these little beacons of positiveness that you are drawn to, and you choose an upholstery swatch, or you choose your floor tile, or whatever. So we were busy. You know, we designed a whole new everything, a whole new entity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to eat a lot around the country.
Yeah,
I got ideas from there. I got ideas from the looks from restaurants around the country. And it was, you know, the end of the day when we reopened, it was magical.
Yeah.
Because we came from the worst to first.
Yeah.
In my eyes.
We're sitting here. I haven't had the benefit of eating yet. We're going to have dinner tonight.
We are.
What's one or two things? What's new? What's new that I'm going to taste that you're particularly proud of that's like part of the work product of this time you had to
It is now
develop.
Fall.
Yeah.
And so I do try and cook seasonally, even though
it's 80 degrees outside.
Even though the palm trees will never turn to orange and yellow.
I'm not joking, by the way. It is 80 degrees outside.
I try and cook seasonally or think in that manner.
It's all relative.
And so I have a dish. It's lamb loin. And I'll take almost a case of sweet onions, like Vidalia onions, and slice them really thin.
Yeah.
Put them in the oven and char them till they're black. And I put that in a food processor, turn it into dust. I call it onion ash.
Mm-hmm.
So I will roll this lamb loin in this black onion ash, grill it off, and I'll make what I call a Greek salad. It's a finely brunoised tomato, feta, cucumber, mint, red onion. And it gets put into the little ring mold and nicely applied to the plate.
Mm.
And a sauce, if you will, of roasted red tomatoes, sun-dried tomatoes, red wine vinegar, and feta is made. It's like a really thick vinaigrette.
Mm-hmm.
And when you cut into that meat, you have the beautiful maroon meat with this black coating around it. And it looks good. It tastes good. It's a little bit different. And this idea started from I wanted to do something different from a burger. And I didn't want to just put a slice of onion on a burger. So I made, I attempted this onion ash, and it was delicious. You know when you open up a can of coffee and you got that, you have that whiff of coffee?
Yes.
The same thing with this onion ash. It just smells great.
Potent. Yeah.
And so we coated burgers in that, and it was to die for. Just so, it was stupid good.
Yeah.
And that dish is on fire right now. And one thing that I've never tried to do is I've never tried to do like an old school dish. By that, I mean like a Milanese or a piccata or anything like that. But a customer wanted a piece of fresh grouper, which comes right from these waters, piccata style. So, okay, so we'll make one for you. And we made two, and we ate one in the kitchen. And it was phenomenal. So we do a cappellini pasta, lemon-scented, room temperature, not cold, not hot, a nice piece of roasted grouper, and some piccata sauce with caper and lemon. I can't cook them fast enough. You know, there is, as you know, an older clientele here in Florida.
Sure.
And that's a dish that, you know, they can remember from way back, that term piccata. And it sells, I mean, I sell out almost every night. If I get in 30 portions of grouper, I'm going to sell 30 portions of grouper. So, you know, we try and keep it familiar without too much fuss, but we buy great ingredients, and I've got a good crew in the kitchen. They execute great. I'm looking forward to seeing what you think tonight.
Awesome.
You know, you've eaten a lot of good places, so this is a good litmus test for me. Either I'm going to close the doors forever tonight, or we're going to open again. Based upon what you think.
Okay. Well, something tells me I'm going to be a very happy camper. Thanks for making the time.
Nah, it was an honor, as I told you. You know, it's, you know, when you move away from New York and you move away from all of the center of the universe, all the media and all the reviewers and everything, and you come to a smaller community, you miss it.
You miss
the talk, you miss the banter,
yeah,
the back and forth exchanges. So for me, it's old home day. It's catching up, and it was much loved. So thank you so much.
Well, and, you know, we've known each other a long time.
And we have.
Yeah, this might... Well, no, we've had a meal. I was going to say this might be one of the longer conversations we've had, but we've had a couple of meals.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's great to be down here. I would tell anyone listening, if you find yourself in Vero Beach, Florida, or close enough, come by the Citrus Grill House.
Let me know. Call the restaurant.
And check it out. The view, I have to say, in addition to what I'm sure will be an amazing meal, the view here is just killer. I mean, to sit out here and look at this is something else.
I didn't make that, but... We did buy it.
Yeah. And that's our show for this week. A huge thank you to Rocco DiSpirito. Stay tuned in the coming weeks for part two of that conversation. And to Scott Ferricchio of Citrus Grill House. If you're in the Vero Beach area, please visit him down there. Thanks to David Tatasciore, our engineer, for splicing these things together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And we will see you back here soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.